Welcome to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast with Alex Dean and Brian Cunningham. Here we have a drink, have a laugh, and you just might learn something about our favorite stories from history.
Please visit our website at hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you like the show, please rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Cheers.
Cheers, everybody. Welcome back to the Hidden History Happy Hour with Alex and Brian.
Cheers. Alex, good to see you.
I almost had to pop another bottle of champagne because every single show we have some movement, but I'm running a little bit low. So congratulations on the candidate for the constituency of Finchley and Golders Green. Correct. And I want you to tell us all about it. But I have to know, who is your pick to play you in Yes, Prime Minister 2045?
Well, by that time, it's someone who's not born yet, obviously, because it's going to have to be a very dashing, young, handsome man. Possibly someone in his, you know, very early teens at the latest. So I haven't reviewed the child actors well enough. But you know, the Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, they really hold up. They hold up not least because they demonstrate the power of the civil service, and they also demonstrate the, you know, cock up rather than conspiracy, that most things are just blunders rather than, you know, some mystical plans. And I always, when people put these conspiracy theories to me about British politics, as they do from time to time, I say, my party or, you know, Number 10 or the Treasury, whatever, is no better at keeping a secret than any other organization. And there is just no chance you could do that and not leak.
Yeah. Well, I once made that point about the JFK assassination, and my answer was, well, you faked the moon landing.
you can't win.
You can't win with some people. So tell us about the constituency, tell us about the process, and most importantly, assure us that you're not going to conduct a coup or any of the other crazy stuff that we talk about in Lessons from History.
Well, I mean, it's one seat of 650, so a coup would seem unlikely. And it's Margaret Thatcher's old seat.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, but that's slightly misleading in that the boundaries have changed somewhat. You know, it has that great honourable name, but it's quite a difference in both complexion and, you know, society's moved on, demographics are different. But it's a tremendous seat in many ways. It's the seat with the most Jewish people in the United Kingdom.
Mazel tov.
Mazel tov, indeed. The fact that I am a Zionist, I think probably didn't hurt. And I've always made the point in my broadcasting, when people ask about this kind of thing, especially when people are lied between British Jews and Israel, you know, British Jews have had a really incredibly hard time since October the 7th, which is rather ironic given that it was Israel that was attacked. But anyway, and I've sought to make the point that that is a farce even on its own merits, because not all Jews are Zionists and not all Zionists are Jews. I am a Zionist and I am not Jewish. It makes more sense to have a go at me than it does to have a, you don't know if the Jewish person you're talking to is a Zionist or not, whereas you know I am. Right, so you're better off slinging your abuse at me. Anyway, so went through the selection process last week. There was a final of three in front of the association membership, but before that, there was a long list process as well. And it's come about, forgive a moment of seriousness, it's come about because my predecessor, the incumbent member of parliament, Mike Freer, received a significant number of credible death threats. Investigated by the police, and we of course have had two parliamentarians murdered in recent times in the United Kingdom. To demonstrate the validity of those concerns, came along in the dead of night and set fire to the association office. It's still in a state. We hope to have at the Margaret Thatcher Centre, Margaret Thatcher House. We hope to have it back up and ready at some point, and, you know, fit for meetings and so forth. But at the moment, it is not, and it rather demonstrated the heightened concerns of people in the community I aspire to represent. So, my point: I aspire to this, to have this campaign as a model of civility. You know, a demonstration of the fact that, you know, the opponents that I'm going to have in this election, all of whom, by the way, have been in selected before I was, so I'm coming late to that environment, all of them seem to me to be remarkably decent human beings with whom I happen to have any number of profound policy differences.
Yeah.
And we have more in common on that basis. That which unites us is more significant than that which divides us. And what we're divided from is the people who choose to come in the dead of night rather than enter into the battle of ideas and set a building on fire. You know, those are the actual, the people we really need to distance ourselves from. So it's going to be, there are going to be any number of robust policy debates in this election, but I'm going to be, I aspire for all of us to come out the other end of it being really proud that we've demonstrated democracy working.
Well, if anybody can pull that off in today's environment, you can, my friend.
Thank you.
Say briefly, I have a very good new Israeli-American friend who lives in, happens to live in California now. And he was talking, this was a month and a half ago, even before a lot of the recent violence and activity. And he was talking with his wife, if for some reason we had to leave America, where would we feel safe? And above London, above Paris, above anywhere else in Europe, they picked the United Arab Emirates as a Jew.
Well, I hear you. Look, I've should I prevail in this election, a future constituent of mine was doing media about how British Jews feel at the moment. And he said he's got a son who lives in Israel, and they were comparing notes. And the son said, I feel safer. This is after October the 7th. This is during rocket attacks. Said, I feel safer living in Israel than you are in London, Dad. And that is, even if it's halfway true, that is an indictment of the situation in my country.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good here either in the U.S., but it's, I think, much worse, it's, at least in terms of actual, you know, violent threats.
Right. Well, because what people say is when Jews in Hungary or Poland or Germany saw things creep on bit by bit, they thought, it can't happen here. We're part of society. Yeah. You know, and by the time you realize you should have gone, it's too late. And so people are very attuned to these signals, and are we safe on the street is a pretty bloody big one.
Yeah. What would you say are your kind of top three legislative priorities?
Yeah. So crime and anti-Semitism definitely is definitely one of the big areas of focus. There's a lot of concern about overdevelopment. So I'm all for what we, you know, gentle density, 6-8 story buildings down the high streets. Sure. 28, 30 story tower blocks next door to someone who, you know, saved all their lives and bought a modest suburban home. Not so much.
Yeah.
There's kind of some concern about that. Then we have this thing called the ultra low emission zone, ULEZ. And that became kind of internationally famous for 5 minutes, because after Boris Johnson resigned and they triggered a by-election in his seat, everyone thought we were going to lose that. But because the Labour Party were in favour of extending ULEZ out to that area, it's kind of, you know, not wealthy people. It's the people who need their vehicles to carry on their small business, their, you know, entrepreneurial one-man band operations. And they're suddenly being asked to pay quite a significant amount of money for the privilege of driving something they've owned for a while. So my point is it hits most the people who can afford it the least.
Yeah.
So with the North Circular in my patch, which is a big road in London, that'll be quite a significant concern, I think. But all that, and if I can squeeze a fourth, it'll probably be faith schools and private schools, because there's discussion of putting VAT on school fees and taking away charitable exemptions for schools, and that would be a big. I think it's completely wrong to punish people who are trying to do the right thing and bring up that. I would go the other way. I would give a small tax, not the whole thing, but I give a small tax rebate to people that contribute for something, trying to do the best for their children that they've already paid for. They've already paid their taxes for the state. And then from their taxed income, they go on and pay a bit more for their own children. So I would I give them a tax rebate. I certainly wouldn't start taxing them more.
So last question from a political science major. Do you see your district, your constituency, as being more independent, or will they sort of get caught up in whatever wave is happening nationally, or hard to tell?
So it's like law, you know, every case turns on its own facts. Every constituency has its own hinterland and issues. This one in some ways more than others, partially because of the background you and I have just been discussing. Right. But I also, the national mood will affect it greatly. So I'm kind of fudging and saying both, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, Listen, governance of the free world is one thing, very important. But how's little Henry?
Thank you very much. Henry's all right. In my constituency to be, if I'm lucky, they're going to be celebrating Purim tomorrow. So it's my favorite religious festival, the rattles and lots of drinking. I'm hoping to not get the paint so much. But anyway, lots of celebration tomorrow. So I'm doing that. And for our first time, I'm away from Henry. So my wife has gone to my in-laws for a couple of days. I really miss him. But he does not yet seem to have realized that daddy isn't around. He's very happy with his grandparents who dote on him, and they're over the moon to have him. I really miss him.
Yeah. Well, that's how it's supposed to be.
It is. Hey, before we just tell a story, one public service announcement. As we hit record, I got the news alert that the Princess of Wales has been diagnosed with cancer.
Yes.
And that will not be news to anyone listening to this by the time it goes out. But nevertheless, we at the Hidden History Happy Hour wish to express, as long with my entire country and people around the world, our best wishes and sympathy for the Princess of Wales.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if they've talked about the kind of cancer, but I do know from my own family's experience that it's a lot. Many, many, many cancers are much easier to treat successfully than they were even 5 years ago.
Modern medicine is a miracle, and we must pray and put our faith in it.
Well, look, yes, indeed. So little inside baseball, although regular viewers and listeners will know this. And by the way, thanks to all of you, we now are in a happy position of every single one of our second season episodes is well over 1,000 views. So thank you very much for that. But as they'll know, Alex, you and I for a couple decades now almost have worked with a company called Palantir Technologies, proudly so. And I guess it's just a coincidence that their motto is Save the Shire, given our story.
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell the story. Knight of the Shires is an expression we always use in the United Kingdom for these kind of buffed and tufted and old colonel type, normally backbenchers, getting on in years, roaring their views across the House of Commons. And some of the stories that I've told in my books are about great achievements, and some have outrageously, from my audience on Twitter, been accused of being excuses to stitch together anecdotes about somebody. And this is in the spirit of the latter.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell the story of Sir Walter Bromley Davenport, who was one of the great knights of the Shires, and one whose obituary kindly euphemized him as having a somewhat simplest view of politics. I think a very charming way of talking about the recently departed. He was the welterweight boxing champion of the British Army. He was commissioned into the Grenadier Guards, and he raised and commanded a regiment from his beloved Cheshire upon the outbreak of the Second World War. And I think it's very likely that that background, Brian, influenced his approach to politics. He became the Member of Parliament for Knutsford, and he held that role for 25 years. And he was renowned for bellowing for quiet in meetings of his fellow members, upbraiding the ill discipline evidenced in the modern era by, as he called them, you young officers. And he would invariably scream at Labour MPs to take their hands out of their pockets. So that's...
Well, he probably would not get on with Doug Fetterman in the United States.
It's that kind, exactly. You've got his measure. So whilst his contributions in Parliament generally fell into the category of behaviour, later described by a speaker, we've got a speaker called John Bercow, who rather liked the sound of his own voice, and he would just say people were chuntering from a sedentary position, phrases like that. So Walter went in for that sort of thing. But he once ventured into a junior position in government, and it was not a success. He, Sir Walter, had been made a whip, which is the like in your Congress, the disciplinary role. On the one hand, one sort of sees the logic, right? His whole life was about discipline. Exceptionally loud voice, passion for keeping people in line, distinct lack of shyness, both in generally and in administering discipline, sort of made sense. On the other hand, he was really concerned about lack of discipline amongst you. If you're a whip, you get assigned certain MPs who you look after your charges. And we now have family friendly sitting hours in Parliament. So Parliament sits late far less often, but it used to sit well into the night. And this story is about back in those days when it sat late. The issue being voted on really doesn't matter for the story. The point is, as happens to whips from time to time in your country and in mine, Bromley Davenport was having trouble corralling those for whom he was responsible in order to ensure that they voted with the Conservative Party. And some whips believe to this day that you catch more flies with honey. That was not Sir Walter's point of view. So he was already perturbed by the frustrating fact that his charges weren't, you know, falling immediately into obedient line in front of him when he ordered them to. In the distance, he spied one of his MPs scuttling to leave the parliamentary estate before the vote, scuttling to leave the Commons. And his temper rose and he shouted the man's name, and the retreating MP ignored him completely. You know, as Homer Simpson said, "Why, you little..." And Bromley Davenport ran after him and delivered an almighty Bromley Davenport boot to the MP's backside. And only after said MP fell down the stairs in front of them as a result, did it turn out that it wasn't his MP at all. It was the Belgian ambassador. Thus, Brian ended Sir Walter's career in government. And, you know, all just for kicking a diplomat down the stairs, I have no doubt he would have said.
Does that is that why you're drinking that beer? Is that a Belgian beer?
It, matter of fact, good spot. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I themed it. I themed it to the story. I'm on my beloved Belgian beers. I will. Well, he also late in life, I mean, he was obviously clearly aggressive to the end. Beloved famously by most of his constituents, at least one didn't feel that way because he broke into his house with an axe and sought to do Sir Walter. It was an advanced years by that point. Sir Walter Bromley Davenport roundly won that contretemps. And was seen chasing the villain down the street, yelling, I don't know why this is his battle cry, "Don't let the NHS get me." They don't make them like they used to.
Wow, that's a good one. Well, I'm having a very nice local Matthews. Do you say claret or claret? I forget.
I say claret.
Yeah, okay. Very good. I didn't actually entirely think it through, but... I will now dedicate this to the blood on the Belgian ambassador's forehead.
Perfect.
That must have been there. So, one, it sounds to me like quite the opposite of catching more flies with honey. His view was you deal with flies with the fly swatter.
And yeah, which is, if you're trying to get the flies to do what you want, seems an interesting approach, right?
Baby in the bathwater. And then the other thing I wanted to say, just kind of a squaring the circle of politics here, is complete coincidence, but my first job out of a university was as a field coordinator on a United States Senate campaign. And yeah, my first job location was at Davenport, Iowa.
Gosh.
I don't know Davenport, if there's any connection at all, but yeah, that's what it's called. Yeah.
Well, there probably is, but you know, I love the connections between your country and mine, the names, the family roots, and so forth. On the, I think it's called the Peace Gate, that stands on the extreme western end of the border between the United States and Canada. There's a motto on each side. And I spoil the story by not remembering the Canadian one. But the American motto says, "Two children of one mother," meaning of the Britain, meaning of the empire. And I've always liked that.
Well, that must not be far from me because I'm in Washington State. It must be just north.
It's Peace Park. And that Peace Park, which was started, you had a little contretemps with loyal British North America and you Tearaways. Sort of brushing over that little awkwardness, they dedicated, with the time, it was just, they just did the gate, I think, in a little area around it. But over time, it's grown into a park on both sides. And the reason I know about it is that it was one of the few cross-border areas in the world that people could still go to during COVID, because you, as long as you left on your side of the park, they got a bit more strict about it and telling people you had to report in as you came back. But as long as you went back to your side of the park, you could go in during COVID. And supposedly, in the original treaty of peace between Canada and the United, don't test the truthfulness of this one too closely, but certainly it was widely used in the reporting at the time. If you closed the gates and closed the park, you broke the treaty between the United States and Canada. That gate was always to be open. And therefore your policing is around the edge of the park rather than actually at the gate. So people would get Canadian, it's famous kind of border marriages might take place there as well. Yeah.
I don't know if it's related, but there's another area right up north of us, between Washington State and I guess it would be British Columbia, where there's, I can't remember the details, but there's an island that is legally in Canada, but you can only get to it by taking a boat from the American side or something like that. It's a weird, like,
right.
Berlin type situation. And those
right.
people got completely screwed for a long time during COVID because most of them would, or a lot of them would go to the island.
Oh,
to,
it's inhabited. Okay, sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah, yeah, no,
okay.
There's a whole town there. So they,
Wow.
They couldn't go to work because they're in their town and
they're
not
in a different country.
US. Yeah, right. The economy just tanked there because they couldn't get supplies. They had no tourists. I'll have to look that up. Maybe I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, let's talk about that on the next one because these things always fascinate me. You know, there's an exclave of Germany in Switzerland. I think it's called Busingen, like a single little village. Mm-hmm. There, of course, there were tons of exclaves of West Germany in East Germany and vice versa, including East Berlin and West Berlin. There's a clutch of Belgian exclaves in the Netherlands, including some that contain exclaves within exclaves. So I've always been interested in these border things, but the island ones are always fascinating.
Yeah, I'll dig that up and we'll talk about it. And of course, you know, there's hundreds of large communities that are actually Russian, but isolated from Russia, like Putin calls Poland one of those.
that's rather different.
I know, I took it dark. I'm sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Got to keep it a little bit current events relevant. So that's I think we call that guy a codger in the United States.
Yeah, we call him an old codger. Yeah. That's fine. I got a second story that's also about an old codger. Billy McMahon, I'm going to the other side of the world now. Billy McMahon was a minister in Australian government for 21 years, continuously. Now, given that they have three-year parliamentary sessions, that is a record and an especially remarkable feat in a political environment famous for its brutality. Australian politics, which I love and have worked in, is really brutal. Alas, Billy McMahon is best remembered for finally, at age 63, becoming prime minister and then promptly being thrashed by the Labour Party by a guy called Gough Whitlam, who is so totemic a leader that a very successful band named themselves after him, albeit he only lasted one term. Anyway, soon into McMahon's single prime ministerial term, he was holding forth, or trying to hold forth, on the price of basic commodities. And he did not like being asked questions, which I think is a tricky tendency in any democratic political system. And frustrated by the subject being repeatedly raised with him about commodity prices, he complained that this is a subject that should not be made a political football, which is a sort of woolly, pseudo-profound remark that politicians sometimes end up with. And this Labour MP called Chris Herford said, not in my view, not unreasonably, if that's your position, what is politics about?
Yeah, exactly.
And finally, McMahon finally knew he was on solid ground, and he turned to face Herford, and in words that ring, because they have a Hansard system like ours, have a recorded parliamentary exchanges. In words that ring forth today from Australia's Hansard, he said, "Politics is trying to get into office." I mean, rarely is truth so distilled and delivered on the floor of a parliament, even if by accident. But I also wanted to make one other point, because I met the other person in this story. McMahon was really good at making enemies. And when he finally got in to become prime minister, his bitterly disliked predecessor was a guy called John Gorton. And he got rid of all the Gorton supporters from his cabinet. And one was Jim Kellen, who is always known as the magnificent Jim Kellen. And McMahon was blundering about at the dispatch box and sought to endear himself to the House with some self-deprecation. And he said, "Oh, I'm my own worst enemy." And you know, from the back benches, Killen's voice could be heard, "Not while I'm alive." I'm alive. It's really good. Huh? And I met him, and he would still tell stories like that.
Well, both your legislature and Australia's, unfortunately, these days have a much better sense of humor than my own. It's we need more of that. We need more of that. And to that end, I'm sure you'll recall, but maybe a lot of people don't remember this, that an American columnist, polemicist in the 1980s, I think, once said that a gaffe is when you accidentally tell the truth.
Right.
And that's
not a bad line, that.
Yeah. So the other thing I want to mention, though, on a quasi more serious note, is this. I know this story didn't explicitly touch on it, but this idea of officials subjected to elections shutting their constituents out of the conversation, which I know you would never do. But our Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, this week, today's Friday, this week, the week of March 20th, that week, heard a case of a couple of state legislators, I think in Missouri, in our state of Missouri, who had banned, had blocked their constituents from commenting on their official X, formerly known as Twitter, account.
Right.
And so this became...
And someone legislated over that, went all the way to the Supreme Court.
It was a state legislator, a couple of them, and they blocked these people. And it worked its way all the way up through the courts to the Supreme Court, because it's a case of the right to the freedom to petition your government, which is in our First Amendment.
But those people could still write a letter to their congressman, right? Or to their state representative.
Theoretically, but, I don't know how the case is going to come out. It's always hard to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. But they didn't sound very sympathetic to the state government officials. And some of the questioning was along the lines of, well, yeah, they could send a carrier pigeon too, but your responsibility, they were asking these in terms of questions.
Right.
But a legislator should allow petitioning, first of all, by any appropriate means, not throwing rocks through your window with a note attached, but any appropriate means, but certainly shouldn't be blocking it on the most common way that people use to communicate in a particular age. So it's
fascinating. But yeah. I would think, if they block their email address, I might think well, let's see how the case goes. But it seems to me if the more formal way that you would normally communicate with an elected representative might be via email. That's the you can still communicate with them electronically, was the point I was getting at. But almost always you get to the extreme. So I imagine these weren't people who just tweeted their state representative
once.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, the other thing I might have left this fact out is that X accounts were the official, state right. representative Jim.
No, Smith you didn't leave that out. That's account,
their personal account.
Right. It's a point well made.
Yeah, and the other thing I think that's going to have some sway over the justices is that I think most of the conservative justices, which are the majority, believe that the closer you get to the people, the fewer people you represent, the more local you are, the more
open you should
have
be.
That right to petition. Yeah, so
I think that's true. So of the ones that I know, I think Gorsuch has expressed something broadly along those lines. But it's not it's quite an esoteric topic for come out, but I could certainly see Clarence Thomas thinking that. Roberts, of course, is a much more slippery character now than he was when he was nominated. But
I would say judicious and looking out for the institution of the court. But
that's true. You say potato, exactly. Did I tell you the reason that I'm slightly cautious on this one? Look, if it's an official email account that you would not have but for your office, or Twitter account that you would not have but for your office, it might be a different thing. The reason I'm slightly more defensive about this is that in the United Kingdom, in this run-up to our election period, a real and worrying trend has emerged of protesters, especially on environmental issues, but also around Israel, Palestine, and so forth, of going to members of parliament's homes, their private addresses. They hung a banner off of, they climbed up and hung a banner off the prime minister's house. Well, if they can do that, given the prime minister's probably got the best security of any member of parliament, they can do that to any of them, of going and haranguing them outside their own front door, of shouting at them as they go down the street. And of course, when you do that, you don't make it more likely that you get your cause advanced. You make it more likely that our politicians are withdrawn away from us and are less of us and amongst us and more of a class apart and separated and have more security around them because they need protecting from you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great point. And of course, we had January 6th and we had people going to Justice Kavanaugh's house to try to, they were certainly equipped to do harm to him if they had gotten in. So that's a valid concern on the other side. But it's interesting how Well, and I've gotten death threats from the stuff that I do on X in support of Israel and Ukraine. I don't think they're credible, but I've gotten them. But it is, it's just another example of how this technology has just become central to everything. Oh, right. Look, I figured this out, by the way, Alex. Remember how I used to get balloons sometimes?
Yeah.
So there's some sort of capability in Zoom that I have not figured out how to turn off that based on what hand movements you do, it, well, now, of course, now it's not going to do it. But yeah. Anyway, that's what triggered that thumbs up. Although I did appreciate your point also.
For anyone who's listening to this episode has now completely lost the point of what we're talking about. But fair enough. I just want to, so let me close with this point then, because I think not one of the virtues of British politics is that it is, you get down to the grassroots level, it's broadly speaking, open, quite relaxed, based on polite discourse and the agreement to disagree. And those things are breaking down. They're breaking down because of this kind of aggression and this approach, and you shout at someone. And the result is we will have a coarser politics that is less relaxed and less open. And we, it's not that we will have success in our community hall events through realizing you're shouting about stopping oil or whatever. It's that we'll have fewer community hall events and we'll have fewer hustings, and MPs will be remote and apart from us. And that's not what I want.
Well, I think, unfortunately, my country is way down that road already, and I don't wish it on you. So here's to you preventing it from happening single-handedly in the UK.
No pressure. Cheers.
Yeah. Hey, listen, everybody. Great to have you. This is a quick episode. We hope you've enjoyed it. We'll see you next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Hidden History Happy Hour podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast app. And if you have questions, comments, or suggestions for topics, you can find us on Twitter or on our website, hiddenhistoryhappyhour.com. We look forward to joining you next time.
Much gratitude to our multi-talented production team of Jeremy Corr, Kate Cruz, and Grace Keller, and to our visionary executive producer, Ivan Williams. And thanks also to our art designer, David Wardle,
without whom this podcast would be, well, history.
Cheers.